This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. The president is America's chief executive, and few government jobs build executive experience like being the mayor of New York. The city has about 500,000 employees, more than 8 million residents, and a budget of nearly $93 billion. Running it teaches you a lot about leading a major enterprise, quite different than another New York institution, the Trump Organization. Mayor Bill de Blasio hopes to make the case that he is the right executive to replace Donald Trump in the White House. How is he making that case to Democratic voters? And what do you want to know? Mayor Bill de Blasio joins us from NPR in New York. Mr. Mayor, welcome to 1A.
Thanks very much, Joshua.
Let's start with the same question we begin with for all of our candidates. Why should the American people elect you president?
Joshua, I think you gave the context in the beginning. Look, I run the nation's largest city. I have the largest school system in the country, the largest police force in the country. And my job every day is to help 8.6 million people, the most diverse place on earth, to make sure that people get along and coexist positively, to have a strong social fabric. Look, what does America need right now? We need a government that will actually try to create a more positive, inclusive society. That's what I've been doing in New York. We need a government that will be on the side of working people, and it hasn't been for a long time. Too often, what's been obvious is the federal government is on the side of the 1%. And here in New York, we've done the exact opposite. We've focused on addressing inequality. We've focused on putting money back in the hands of working people with things like pre-K for every child for free, and paid sick days so folks don't have to choose between going to work or taking care of themselves. You know, the things that we are doing here, $15 minimum wage, Green New Deal, putting it into effect here, these are the things that a lot of my competitors for the nomination, good people, Joshua, but they're talking about ideas and theories, and they're honest about it, I know. But these are things I'm already doing in a very intense, tough environment. And I'm able to say to the American people, look, I know how to do these things. I've already done them. And ultimately, I think people are looking for that proof point. I've certainly found as I go around Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina and Nevada, folks want to figure out how to differentiate from these good candidates. And it is striking to them when I say, hey, I'm not just, when I say putting working people first, it's not a theory to me. Mm-hmm. I've been doing it on a mass scale and under very tough circumstances. And one more example I've got to use. You know, I believe that the stop and frisk policy, which existed under my predecessor, was punitive and divisive and overly aggressive. It was the wrong kind of policing. It was driving police and community apart. I said we'd get rid of it. And I knew we could be safer if we were also a more fair city. 6 years ago, I got rid of stop and frisk. 6 years in a row, crime has gone down. Being able to say to the American people, I've made my city safer while also repairing the relationship between police and community. This is the kind of thing other candidates are not able to say. And it's exactly what you want to be able to do when you take on Donald Trump, mm-hmm. to present not just an ideology or a vision, but to say, I know how to actually lead and run this giant organization that is the federal government, which we all know Donald Trump didn't come in with that expertise, and it hurts us every single day as a nation.
Well, since you brought up law enforcement, maybe that's a good place to start. Here is a recent exchange from the last set of Democratic debates, the ones that were held in Detroit on July 31st. Here's part of an exchange with CNN's Jake Tapper.
There's finally going to be justice. I have confidence in that in the next 30 days in New York. You know why? Because for the first time, we are not waiting on the federal Justice Department, which told the city of New York that we could not proceed because the Justice Department was pursuing their prosecution. And years went by and a lot of pain accrued. And in the meantime, what I'm working on is making sure, and I have for 5 years, there will never be another tragedy. There'll never be another Eric Garner because we're changing fundamentally how we police.
Part of an exchange in response to a question from CNN's Jake Tapper during the last set of Democratic debates. We did get some questions about the Eric Garner case. One of our listeners tweeted, when will he fire Officer Pantaleo? An administrative judge has ruled he should be fired for the murder of Eric Garner, yet the police chief refuses to fire him. Will Bill de Blasio commit to firing this officer and making sure he won't receive a pension or benefits? Mayor?
Yeah, Joshua, I'm really glad you asked the question because this is a cause of so much passion for good reason. A horrible injustice occurred with the death of Eric Garner. And then a second injustice that the United States Department of Justice for 5 years literally did not act. And there's not precedent for that. For decades and decades, the Justice Department would step in. There would be a trial. There would be justice. There would be a process where you'd actually get to have the evidence aired. That never happened for Eric Garner. And the pain of it was the Justice Department telling the city of New York, don't act. We're doing this. And then they didn't. The city of New York, through our police department, held a public trial. A NYPD judge said guilty, should be terminated. Now, what your listener put in that question is honestly inaccurate and unfair. And I wish people would try and get the facts, because this is a passionate issue, but we have to be factual. State law says here in New York, the police commissioner is the person who makes the final decision. He hasn't refused to make a decision. He is waiting for the formal opportunity to make a decision that can only happen when the judge allows the next step. And that is literally going to happen in a matter of days during this month of August. So this process that New York City has done is the first time there's actually been a justice process. It's clearly been fair and impartial because the NYPD itself found the officer involved guilty. So I understand it's painful that this process takes time, but I keep saying to people, look that there's finally been a trial and look that there's been impartiality, because bluntly, a decade or two ago, you would not have assumed that a major police department would necessarily be the place you would turn for justice compared to the United States Department of Justice. Well, guess what? The world is now flipped on its head. We can't depend on the Justice Department, but because of the reforms and changes we've made here in New York, the NYPD's justice system actually is functioning objectively.
And just a quick follow-up, Mayor. I just want to make sure I understand where you're coming from. With regards to the question and asking whether you will commit to firing the officer, making sure he doesn't receive pension benefits, it sounds like part of what you're saying is that it's not your call, that's the chief's call. Is that it?
It's the by state law. Thank you again, Joshua, for asking, because I want people to understand this. Even with all the honest passion out there, these facts matter. New York state law says this is a personnel matter. This is the decision of the person who runs the agency, who is the police commissioner. Now, interfering in that can cause an ultimate decision to be overturned in a court of law. I've said this very openly, Joshua, and I wish people would hear it. I'm being pretty straightforward. I'm not going to interfere. I'm not going to violate the process, because I see a fair and impartial process finally happening. And Joshua, look, of course, the thing I'm most devoted to here is making sure there's never, ever another tragedy like this. And we've made a host of changes in policing that really, I think, make it very, very different today in New York, where this would not happen. But the other point to remember here is we now have to say, and I hate to say it, but we now have to say, if God forbid there was another tragedy, we would not even wait for the Justice Department to become involved, because we no longer have faith they would do their job. And we would proceed to our internal process immediately. And that's something that pains me, because remember, what the NYPD can do is only about employment. What the Justice Department does is about much more serious charges. But they have proven, and this was over two administrations, they've proven now that they're actually capable of total inaction. That's not the Justice Department I used to know, but so, I think we're in a different world.
So do you agree that the officer should be fired?
Joshua, it's the exact same point. I've said it before. I'll say it for clarity. I am not offering an opinion so long as this process is going on, because I do not want to undermine the sanctity of a process and then prolong it potentially in court. I'm trying to help the city turn this page. I'm trying to help make sure there is justice and closure, because we have a lot more work to do to ultimately fix this relationship between police community.
One of the other stories related to law enforcement in New York that broke this week was that two NYPD officers killed themselves this week. That brings the total number of NYPD suicides to 9 for the year so far. Now, that follows a bigger nationwide trend. America's suicide rate is at its highest level since World War II. First of all, condolences for the deaths of those officers. I know that NYPD has got to be shook over that. But beyond that, what would you do as president about mental health in this country, not just for police officers, but for everyone?
Joshua, I do appreciate you raising what we're going through here. It's incredibly painful. Our officers serve us in every community. People know, because one of the things we've done as neighborhood policing to actually build relationships between our police and our officers very personally, very individually. So when we lose an officer to suicide, it's very personal for the people of the city and obviously the members of the department. And I sent a message out to the department about something very personal of my own. I wanted to say to people, I hope this helps because we've all been through this. And one in five Americans experiences a mental health challenge. Every family affected. In my family, it was my dad, who served in World War II, who came back from the Battle of Okinawa with half a leg blown off by a grenade, who suffered physically, but much more over the years, suffered emotionally, spiraled downward. I was young watching this very good man, this very strong man, descend into alcoholism, depression. He ultimately took his own life. And my dad was someone to admire in so many ways, but he could not overcome what we now know as PTSD. And he didn't know how to accept help. People tried to offer it to him. He felt the stigma. He felt it would people would think there was something wrong with him. He felt he could take care of his problems himself. And I sent that message out, that story of my own family's experience to the men and women in NYPD to try and say, no matter, you know, how good a person, how good a public servant, how strong you are, how devoted you are, you know, you still can have a challenge and you should seek help and you should never feel ashamed. And so we are going to have to do that on a much bigger scale in this whole nation. As you said, we're in a mental health crisis.
Right.
And I would only say one thing. What my wife, Shirlane, has been working on here with the Thrive Initiative should be applied nationally. There is no national mental health strategy.
And I do want to hear more about your strategy when we continue our conversation with New York Mayor and 2020 contender Bill de Blasio. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment at your convenience. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. Visit BetterHelp.com/1A to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
These days, Senator Elizabeth Warren is driving around Iowa in an RV campaigning. And on the back,
we have a huge sign that says, "Honk if you want big structural change."
And according to Warren, it is getting attention.
We had truckers coming by, and they were really on the big air horns, and that was fun.
The NPR Politics podcast hit the road to ask Warren about all that structural change she's calling for. Subscribe to listen.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are speaking to His Honor Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York and a 2020 Democratic presidential candidate. Mr. Mayor, I'm going to pick up the pace just a bit because there's a bunch of policy questions we want to ask you. But just to close the loop on mental health, what's at the top of your agenda? Give me one concrete policy proposal that you would have as president to address mental health briefly before we keep going.
Yeah, of course. Universal health care, including mental health coverage. Right now, so much of the American health care system, so much of health insurance does not cover mental health. So a universal health care system that does, and a national commitment to creating a single point of contact in every community, as we have here with a phone number, 888-NYC-WELL, where anybody can call 24/7, get peer counselors, get people who can help them with their problems, and then connect them to the next step in their care. That should be available in every corner of the United States of America.
Before we get to listener questions, you announced that New York is going to roll out its own universal health care plan. I know it's not supposed to be in every borough until next year, but are there any early learnings from that might inform you as president in rolling out health care nationwide?
Yeah, absolutely, Joshua. We're finding that when you say to people, healthcare is available to you no matter what, people take advantage and get healthcare. And we want that. So what we decided was we have 600,000 uninsured people. We're giving everyone directly who can't get insurance a healthcare card. They get a primary care doctor assigned to them in our public hospitals and clinics. And we say, if you get sick, go to the doctor. Don't wait till it's worse and worse and then end up in the emergency room. Actually get care when you need it. People are now following that guidance. And I think it's going to lead to a healthier city in many ways and healthier families, but also save ultimately a huge amount of money that's wasted in this country because people go to the emergency room when it's really, really bad. And that's the last place anyone should get the care they need.
All right, let's dive into some listener questions. You know, last week you sat down with Sean Hannity on Fox News. You are the only 2020 Democratic candidate to do so. And there's been this big narrative about kind of the progressives versus the centrists, whether the next Democratic candidate should be, you know, the left or center left or far left. Glenn writes, "You are a millionaire Democratic mayor from a major city. How is the president of all Americans will you balance urban issues, which largely lean Democratic, versus rural issues, which largely lean Republican? In other words, how do you plan to understand the issues of Americans whose lives are so different from yours? Mr. Mayor?
First, Glenn has clearly not seen my bank account. I am by no normal measure a millionaire by any stretch. The fact is, when I go around rural America, I hear the exact same concerns I hear from my constituents in New York. That's, Joshua, that's not a talking point. That's what I've experienced. And what I find is working people have tremendously similar interests, whether they work on a farm or a factory or in a store. And when you put an agenda forward that is literally my three-word slogan, working people first, and talk about things like universal health care, higher minimum wage, making sure people have rights, labor unions have rights to organize, these messages resonate with a lot of folks who, in fact, stayed home in 2016 and a lot of folks even who voted for Donald Trump. And my argument in this big divide in the party, where are we going, is if we're not the party of working people, we run the risk of losing the election. And I mean working people of all backgrounds and ethnicities, because who stayed home in 2016? Who drifted to Trump? Working class folks who are feeling economic stress and desperation and feeling that neither party was addressing their needs and Washington was just for the 1%. Democrats have to be the blunt, bold party of change with an economic progressive agenda. That's how we get back. The reason I went on Hannity, I was willing to spar with Hannity. I disagree with him on essentially everything, but I want to speak to those millions of people who watch his show, because a lot of them have been Democrats, have voted Democrat. They could be brought back if we'd only talk to them with passion about trying to improve their circumstance.
This week, the Trump administration rolled out the so-called public charge rule. It would penalize immigrants who are seeking benefits by letting officials deny them green cards and visas. You are the mayor of a city with millions of immigrants. You know, the Statue of Liberty is out in the harbor, and that's been in the news this week. Yep. Talk about how you deal with America's immigration challenges, particularly the distrust that's been sown among some immigrants towards the federal government in general.
So, Joshua, we are going to sue the Trump administration with a lot of partners, and I believe that public charge rule will be defeated, just like the original immigration executive order when they threatened our security funding. We went to court. We beat the Trump administration. I think we'll beat them again.
And I'm sorry, when you say we, you mean the city of New York?
Yes, the city of New York with the state attorney general and others. We're all going to get together, and I think this can be overturned. And folks should realize that no one who is an immigrant should change what they're doing now based on this attempt by the Trump administration, because I believe it will be overturned. But the bigger point is this. So the Republicans in general, Trump in specific, have weaponized the issue of immigration. And what they've done is consistently peddled this notion to working class people, middle class people who are American citizens, that the immigrants are causing their economic distress, are undermining the American dream, are causing the next generation to not do so well. Somehow they've created this very strong fiction that the immigrants created people's misery and challenges. And I said it on the debate stage, no. Wall Street created that. The big corporations created that. The folks who actually have power, not the guy who works in the kitchen or the guy who works in the fields, the people with power created your challenges and your misery. If you're someone who's struggling, point the finger at the folks who actually did it to you. I think Democrats need to be blunt about that. And honestly, too many Democrats have not been willing to say it that plainly, maybe for fear of alienating, powerful people or donors. I got no problem saying it bluntly. If we don't undermine the politics of the immigration question and the mythology, we will not overcome this roadblock. Joshua, the 11 million or more people, we've had that kind of number of people here undocumented in this country for decades. It's not a quote-unquote invasion. It's a reality. It's American reality. In New York, we get it. They're part of our communities. These are our neighbors. So we treat them with respect and inclusion. But that we just need to have an honest American conversation about, come on, this is America. It's not changing. By the way, in a lot of parts of the country, if we don't give people a path to citizenship, if we don't create a guest worker program, a lot of work won't get done. A lot of crops won't get harvested. The economy won't function. That we have to talk to people on that kind of very honest, practical level as well.
Who do you think are your best allies in the Democratic establishment in Congress for trying to move something with immigration forward? It remains the third rail of politics. Who seems like they're the most facing in the same direction as you?
Oh, I think both in the House and Senate, there's a pretty extraordinary consensus in the Democratic Party about where to go on immigration. keep the Dreamers here, which is an American majority position, pathway to citizenship, end family separation, zero tolerance. These are generally American majority positions. I don't think the problem is the Democratic Party's unity on the issue. I think the problem is the Democratic Party is losing the hearts and minds of too many Americans that we don't need to lose because we're not framing the discussion properly. We need to bring it back to economic reality. We need to bring it back to people's lives. You know, Trump got away with for a while suggesting there was this caravan invasion and it was coming to people's town and a certain number of Americans were taking on face value. We didn't fight back particularly well. I think we need to expose the whole thing. This is one big con job. In fact, the business community of America has winked and nudged at a massive level of undocumented folks being in this country for not just years, for decades. And, you know, undocumented folks work in the factories of all sorts of big corporations. Mm-hmm. Come on. Why don't we have an honest conversation? And I think if we do, and we say to the American people, these working people are not your enemy. Immigrants who are working people are not your enemy. Folks who had the power who made your lives much worse, you know, that's who we need to aim the attention at.
Got a number of questions about helping those who are struggling the most in our society, whether low-income communities or the homeless. Matthew tweeted, I was in his city last week. Lots to celebrate. Great people, art, parks. But there's trash everywhere and people urinating in public. So maybe fix that first, Mayor?
With all due respect to your listener, I know my city really well. This is the safest big city in America. It's well proven. We've gotten safe in 6 years in a row under my watch. There is not trash everywhere. That's just not true. From time to time, you might find someone urinate in public, but it's not a common reality, and we don't accept it.
Although I think there are some cities, Mayor de Blasio, like San Francisco, for example, where I moved from before I came here, where income inequality is just getting worse and worse and worse, and it seems like there's just no solution. What could you do as president to help big cities that are dealing with that that chasm, really growing chasm, between the haves and the have-nots?
So, Joshua, the things that we do in New York make a difference, and they should be done all over the country. We have rent regulation here, rent control. This should be a policy in cities all over the country, in my view, because we have to deal with the reality of gentrification. We have to deal with a changing economy, unless we want to end up with the horrible reality of some parts of the world where all working people and poorer people are forced out of cities. We need to have something like that to give people a reasonable rent. We need to reinvigorate public housing through the infrastructure plan. I believe in a huge infrastructure plan. Public housing should be included. And one other, you know, two examples, very quick. We give free lawyers to low-income and working-class folks who are threatened with a legal eviction. We give them lawyers. It has greatly reduced evictions. And we have a law we put in place. I think it should be all over the country. If a developer wants to build a new building and they need to come for us to us for a permit, they are required to build 20 or 25% or 30% affordable housing, or else they cannot build anything. That should be a law all over this country.
So these are things, because some cities do have that, where you either have to have that ratio or you pay into some municipal fund. Are these things, rent control and low-income kind of requirements, that you would want to mandate as law across the country?
Yeah, look, I think depending on each policy, some of them could be law, some of them could be incentivized. But if you talk about solutions, there is no federal housing policy right now. Let's just be clear. We had the foreclosure crisis. We've had the huge decline in public housing around the country without federal support. The Section 8 program has been reduced and reduced. All the things that actually helped create affordable housing are stuck or reduced. We need an affordable housing program for this country again, especially with what people are going through in more and more urban areas that are pricier and pricier, more and more people living there. What we've done in New York is a series of changes that actually have allowed a whole lot of working class people, middle class people, lower income people to stay here and to live, you know, productive, positive lives. We need to do that all over this country. And it's different tools and different approaches, but let's start with, we need a federal affordable housing policy again.
We're speaking with New York Mayor Bill de Blasio about his run for the Democratic nomination. Just ahead, we'll talk about how he plans to qualify for the next Democratic debate next month, and we'll hear more from you. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Walton Family Foundation, where opportunity takes root. More information is available at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating. That helps other people find the show. And don't forget, you can catch the news roundup at the end of every week.
The world is complicated, but knowing the past can help us understand it so much better.
That's where we come in. I'm Rund Abdelfattah.
I'm Ramtin Arablouei, and we're the hosts of Throughline, NPR's history podcast.
Every week, we'll dig into forgotten stories from the moments that shaped our world.
Throughline from NPR. Listen and subscribe now.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're speaking to Mayor Bill de Blasio of New York about his run for president. I should note that a number of our listeners have asked us questions about the nature of your campaign and its viability. We know that the standard for making the debates in September is going to be tougher for making the debates last month. There has been a Quinnipiac poll that showed that I believe it was 1 out of 5 New Yorkers support your run for president. And we got a lot of questions about just the viability of your campaign in this gigantic field that could change by the time we're off the air.
That's right.
Wicked Cellist tweeted, "What does he think he's adding to the conversation? I see candidates who have the attention to win. I see candidates who have talking points they want heard on a national stage. And then I see a bunch of people who are neither. What is he accomplishing here?"
Well, first of all, Joshua, I'm someone who has been an underdog in every race I've been in, including the one for mayor of New York City. So I think people should never assume 6 months before anyone votes. Literally, the first votes in Iowa are almost 6 months away. No one should assume where this is going. We're in a time where everything is unpredictable. Everything is changing in the politics of this country, and things can change very rapidly. Second, I'm someone who, you talk about the response of New Yorkers, well, they elected me with 73% of the vote, and then a year and a half, they reelected me with 67% of the vote. That's what ultimately matters when you're judged by the voters. And what am I contributing? Look, I'm talking about the direction that our country and our party need to go in when I say working people first. In both debates, I push very hard for a pro-working person vision, pro-labor position that, honestly, a lot of other candidates were not focused on. And I pushed my fellow Democrats to recognize, for example, Democrats cannot be party to a new NAFTA treaty, and a lot of them actually are thinking of doing that. And that's going to totally anger and undermine so many working people, particularly in the industrial Midwest. That can't happen. Democrats need to stand up for labor unions. They have not been doing it sufficiently. Democrats have to be really clear that private health insurance is not something to celebrate. It's something we need to move past, ultimately, with universal health care. You know what? There are relatively few voices on these stages that are giving a clear, sharp, progressive message about working people. And I'm going to ask your listeners to help me keep doing that, because you're right about the debate standards. Anyone who believes that what I'm saying is important to this discourse, please go to BillDeBlasio.com, donate at least $1. The way you get into these debates going forward is through those grassroots donations. And Joshua, the qualifications for September and then October are exactly the same. So I'm going to keep working hard to qualify for both those debates, because I really do think I'm presenting a vision that we need in this party, in this country, and it's based on actually doing the work and achieving it. And I also believe that nothing, you know, the phrase I like is the future is unwritten, which I will credit to Joe Strummer. No one knows where this election is going. And the things I'm talking about actually resonate deeply with working people all over this country.
And it's worth noting that this, just by, for everyone's reference, the standard for the debates next month is the candidates must have 130,000 individual donors and hit at least 2% support in 4 different polls. Also worth noting that around this point in the 2016 election cycle, the very top frontrunner for the Republican nomination was Jeb Bush, and the bottom candidate was Donald Trump. Before we go, a few more quick questions. Let me ask you just a quick foreign policy question. We're dealing with this standoff with China and tariffs. Clearly, the markets are worried about a recession right now. Some economists say there's a 1 in 3 chance that a recession will happen in the next year before the election. Suppose you become a recession-era president. Give me your top priorities, your 1 or 2 top plans for digging the economy out.
Let's borrow from Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was a Depression-era president, a huge national infrastructure plan. Repeal the Trump tax cut for the wealthy and corporations. take those resources and apply them to a massive infrastructure plan, including the Green New Deal, and focus on rebuilding the American economy, putting people to work, putting ourselves on a sustainable economic path. Right now, this country, between the infrastructure problems and the lack of resiliency policy and no real policy to address climate change, those are the long-term, deep, deep threats to our economy. If we actually started addressing that stuff, it would create a huge number of jobs, reinvigorate our economy, and prepare us for the future.
Last question. This may sound like kind of a weird question, but do you really want to leave New York? You're the mayor of New York, man. You really want to come to the swamp and have to work to drain it?
Well, the swamp needs some draining, Joshua. And look, I had to take over New York City and change a lot of things very, very quickly on really tough issues, take on a lot of opposition from very powerful interests to do it. And that's the kind of experience that's actually literally what we need right now to fix Washington and make this a nation that actually focuses on working people again. So, yeah, I want to do that. And I think, look, this is called the second toughest job in America historically. Mm. Having done this, I feel ready to do what I need to do to change this country for New Yorkers, for everyone, and make it a place that puts working people first. And please, again, to your listeners, go to BillDeBlasio.com. Help me stay on that debate stage.
He is the mayor of New York and a candidate for the Democratic nomination, Mayor Bill de Blasio. Mr. Mayor, we really appreciate your time, sir. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, Joshua.
Today's conversation was produced by Paige Osborne and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.